This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The two things are kind of coming together here. On the one hand, the problem of democracy as such and the conditions of democracy in today's sort of globalized world of globalized capital. So the focus is mostly, apart from the theoretical focus, is mostly European, partly because I think this is where the problem is most aggravated, particularly in terms of the relation between immigration and citizenship, although the discussion is open geographically, and it'll be very interesting if we exit that particular terrain. Anyway, so this question, can democracy not be secular? I mean, if one obviously knows my writing, they would say, okay, this is just, he's just setting us up. It's a rhetorical question. It only has one answer. It could be a Socratic question that would also have one answer, you know. Can democracy not be secular? Socrates would ask, and the respondent would say, no, it cannot. Right? But I think that I'm interested in asking it in negative terms, in some ways as an exploratory gesture, in order to see what is the potential that I'm trying to delineate that brings these two notions together, democracy and the secular. I mean, there are the other, if we had time, maybe in the discussion we can do this, there are these two other notions that shadow them, and they are implicit, maybe, and that one would be sovereignty and the other the political. Now, these are, you know, huge notions, very contentious, certainly nothing self-evident about them or innocent. They have a huge history, or histories rather, antagonistic and so on and so forth. What I'm trying to figure out is what the significance of these things is in the contemporary situation, which I'm reading as both belonging to the conditions of modernity, but also affected by what is a different kind of situation in the way that capital works. Though capital is always sort of world building, we may in fact be in a situation that's different from the typical situation that we'd see, let's say, in the 19th century, even in the mid-20th century. And then in the end, I have these assertions, really, about what I've been talking, terming left governmentality, which I will try to give you a sense of what this strange idea might be. In the book and throughout my writings, I've been trying to create a space so that the secular would not be determined by its opposition to the religious, which I find to be misguided and misguiding. So I've been trying to disrupt this relation. The term secular criticism, as you may know, is something that comes from Edward Said from way back. It's a term that pertains to literature, really. It pertains to literary criticism. We can talk about that more. I'm not going to discuss that here in the paper, but we can discuss it later. Just say one thing that, you know, from my standpoint, secular criticism is not a theory, and Said never theorized the notion. It's a gesture to a certain kind of practice, and a certain kind of practice of critical reading that seeks to sort of de-transcendentalize ideas, as I say, including the secular and secularism. So from that standpoint, one might say that whatever may be termed to be religious was always within the realm of the secular, if we don't think of the secular as opposed to religion. From a kind of anthropological standpoint almost, you can say that even you know, those regimes that claim to do the work of God, on Earth, are theocracies, let's say, are secular regimes, because that's what they're doing. They're engaged in real politics. Whatever God may mean for those societies, the political significance is actually in the day to day. My argument is, and this is certainly to be to be argued against, is because it's an assertion that, you know, whatever we term as the divine or the sacred or the holy or the religious, insofar as it becomes political, it becomes secular, regardless of the fact that it understands itself not to be. So religious wars are quintessential, obviously, secular events. In this sense, I'm not just talking about religion as something that has to do with social practices or rituals and so on, but even which take place obviously within specific temporality, right? But I'm talking about even ideas and doctrines even that presume to transcend the particularities of time. My argument is that even they are engaged insofar as they become political, in a kind of in a secular sphere. Usually, we can say that from a kind of insider perspective, this would not hold, obviously. And at the extreme point, it would be a kind of dogmatic position of faithful who would actually say, "My religion is the only true religion." That's the extreme point. But the same can be said about, let's say, so-called secular culture. The extreme point, the extreme insider perspective of so-called secular culture would be, I think, the nationalist position, a kind of cultural nationalism, which is always inevitably implicated in some sort of, if not racist, overtly racist, certainly certain kind of racial perspectives, where, let's say, my culture is superior to other cultures. Right? These are insider perspectives that tend toward a dogmatic position as opposed to positions that would be, in Greek terms, engaged with what was called doxa. And doxa really, strictly speaking, means opinion, but it also means that articulation which is open to contention and discussion. So the notion, for example, of orthodoxy is actually an oxymoron. There can never be a correct or singular or truthful doxa. It's orthodoxy, any orthodoxy of any kind, doesn't have to be religious, is a dogmatic position by definition. So basically, secular criticism is also situated in a kind of oppositional critical standpoint to secularism, which I'm always trying to make a point to distinguish. Secularism is a certain kind of institutional language that pertains, obviously, to state structures, perhaps even ideology, a certain ideology. Secular criticism is a certain practice, a kind of contrarian practice that does not accept dogmatic assertions. In a kind of really broader philosophical vein, which, as much as I'm improvising, is not fair, really, to just kind of throw it out there, but nonetheless, I will. You can go after me on this one because we do need to discuss it. For me, secular criticism is addressed to what I call conditions of heteronomy. Heteronomy I take very, very literally as that which means the condition that means that that law, or one might say the rules by which one lives or society lives, are external. To the space where one lives. They are formulated by some authority that actually exceeds the conditions of in which one lives. It is literally the law of another, but we have to imagine that the law of another really means a law that you have no access to. Okay? This, again, I repeat so as not to be misunderstood, is not only in the domain of the religious. It can easily be in what is called secular politics. The moment a constitution becomes sacred, as they tend to become, then law tends to belong to a kind of realm that is unapproachable, whether it is, you know, the realm of the sacred constitution or the realm of experts, those who are the kind of clerics of today who are the ones that negotiate issues of law outside of our own provenance. So there are, you know, various, I'm going to skip these things. I spoke at length about Some of the political events of the recent years, I'm particularly interested in what has been called the assembly movement phenomenon, which is kind of geographically quite disparate. In this belongs certainly what was called the Arab Spring, certainly what was called the movement of the square assemblies in the square in Spain, Greece, and so on in Europe. But also, you know, the Occupy movement from a certain standpoint, at least in its imaginary. It continues in all kinds of spaces where one least expects it, in Brazil, of course, in Turkey, Gezi Park. These movements cannot be seen to be linked to each other in a direct sense. I think they're linked by a certain kind of resonance. And I'm interested in the kind of politics that they inaugurate without being naive about some kind of revolutionary potential, okay? Nonetheless, in terms of what they say about democracy, these are very interesting phenomena to me. And they are, I call them secular events. And it was very interesting when I wrote this about the Tahrir Square events at the very, very beginning. I was criticized by various, in fact, actually friends who were... making an argument that I was trying to read the Egyptian situation as a kind of Western or from a Western perspective because I call it a secular event, which was really absurd to me. I wasn't talking about the content or the beliefs or whatever the people participating, but about the fact that people from all kinds of disparate, unrelated, heterogeneous standpoints and with incredible differential between them. Assembled together without a plan, really. I mean, in a kind of sort of self-directed fashion, to take over politics that had been revoked from their capacity. And it's very strange to call that westernizing because it seems to me to be actually the reverse. It's a kind of orientalizing gesture. It's as if to say that people outside the West, you know, cannot, you know, act in radical democratic fashion. You know, of course, there were very various others who very Eurocentric positions, which was just as orientalist, that they said, oh, this is nothing, you know, this is not a real revolutionary thing. It's nothing, it's just a kind of something that will amount to nothing, and it's just a venting of dissatisfaction, because real revolutionary tradition, of course, exists in the West, et cetera, et cetera. Those are I think, both of these positions are similar. They're part of the same, let's say, Orientalist coin. We've got to keep in mind that there's nothing authentically anti-Western. I mean, to say that something might be authentically anti-Western is about as Orientalist as anything. In light of this, I'll come back to this in a minute. I want to say something about what I talked about before. The sort of, you know, the France is, of course, at the forefront of this problem, but it's not just, for obvious reasons, I think, and because of the incredible tradition of laïcité in France, this is, maybe that's why it's at the forefront, but it's a general problem in European societies. We know that, the relation between immigration and citizenship. One of the things that we can, which I don't think is a problem of religious difference, that's my argument. It's from a certain standpoint, it's clearly the matter of just simply global capital, meaning, you know, people, large numbers of people are just, you know, uprooting themselves to have, you know, better conditions of labor, you know, a better life, which turns out not to be so much better, of course, that's the other thing. The thing that's certainly characteristic that we cannot deny is that there is a specificity to this problem, which is inevitably, I think, colored by the fact that the societies in which this problem is most prominent were colonial powers. So there is a certain kind of element of, you know, sort of a reversal. People are, you know, sort of returning the favor of breaking the boundaries of sovereignty. You know, I'm talking about colonial populations and sort of doing a kind of reversal, a reverse gesture. But from a certain standpoint, one would think that liberal state has already, you know, preconceived this issue and could handle it. And you know, the 19th century Europe has such examples where citizenship was extended to minorities. That's an interesting discussion which we can also have. This is not happening because I think there is definitely resistance that harkens back to essentially a kind of colonial adversariness or adversary relation. At the same time, we have some countries in Europe, and they kind of are in the periphery, let's say Scandinavia and Ireland to Greece and Italy, for example, where there's major similar problems, and these countries have nothing to do with it. They were not colonial powers. So, and it's arguable, and I'm not obviously a sociologist and so on, and to measure this in any way, that they would not have had a problem had there not been a kind of consolidation of European states even in the haphazard way in which this happened, the European Union. So in a sense, they've inherited a kind of colonial / post-colonial problematic without, you know, unwillingly or unwittingly. And they are incapable of managing it, obviously. Their response, the response of those societies, and we've seen the examples, some of them are terribly violent. Again, think of the north to the south, is a return to a certain kind of hardcore nationalism and its own metaphysics that tries to deal with this issue. And I was wondering whether this may not, in fact, be a political problem, in the sense that I'm borrowing a bit here from Bernard Stiegler, who I've been reading recently. He's been talking about the proletarianization of the consumer. Very interesting argument in the sense that we can recognize it, the way that societies are basically bottoming out in terms of their both a removal of wealth and a kind of impoverishment across the board, and a homogenization in this sense. We may argue then in that in those terms that that immigrant populations, even if they don't have rights, are inducted and therefore excluded, obviously, from citizenship and sovereignty. They're nonetheless inducted in a kind of pool of consumer culture, which in a very strange way assimilates them into whatever society they're in. Something that is not discussed enough in those discourses that try to deal with this problem, that tend to see it as a cultural problem, and of course as a political problem, which it is. It is a political problem. But I think it's also a kind of, it exceeds the classic problem of the juridical political, which has to do with rights and citizenship. And it means that different societies are being created because as a consequence of capital, and these societies mean that different constituencies with different understanding, not just simply of citizenship, but of what might be a mode of demanding political rights or a certain kind of emancipation is coming to being. Which then leads me to this discussion about what I've called left governmentality. Okay, left governmentality doesn't mean anything in this country. I mean, there's no left in this country. It's very hard to say that there is even left in Europe, of course. And so this is very, very targeted. I am, as a result of the assembly movements and also, maybe because in Greece this did go to a certain radical standpoint where it's possible that a real bona fide left party with all of its problems, and has many, might come to power by election. It's an interesting possibility. It raised all kinds of concerns for me as to what this might mean. You know, what does it mean to think of the left in relation to a kind of imaginary or a mentality of governance, which is really how we have to remember the resonance of mentalité in Foucault's notion. In this light, I've been making consistent arguments against the fashion, what I think is sort of a fashionable tendency, primarily, you know, obviously Agamben is the figure that kind of presides over this, but it has a lot of other sources, coming probably going all the way back to where Carl Schmitt and his thinking became fashionable in this country. The tendency to make this argument that we are in a kind of state of permanent exception, and generally making an argument about politics from the standpoint of the exception, you know, the state of emergency position. I'm borrowing a term here from my friend Emily Apter, who's been talking lately of thinking of the unexceptional, of unexceptional politics. So, you know, what would be unexceptional politics? It seems to me, in a sense, democratic politics has to be seriously unexceptional. It has to resist the logic of the exception, which is, after all, a theological concept. If we were to take strictly the interesting challenge that Aristotle poses in his Politics about the fact that in a democratic society, the rulers can only rule if they know what it means to be ruled, and vice versa, creating a certain interesting, not dialectic, but a kind of a reciprocity between the rulers and ruled, where there is no primary position in either of the two, where there's a certain kind of constant circularity and substitutability. I'll get to that in a minute. If we take that seriously, then we are really getting closer to imagining what would be an unexceptional politics, a politics that would not make exceptions. It's a kind of anarchic politics, strictly speaking, in the sense that the arche, and that's the word that Aristotle uses for rule, right, is deconstructed in such a way so as to bar any possibility that arche would actually be primary, which goes against the notion. It's a very interesting way to think about this problem. I'm not used to these devices. Let's skip very quickly here to think about, so let's say austerity politics, for example, is a good example of exceptional politics. It literally draws lines, delineates, it exempts certain people, both lines of the exception. Meaning, some people are essentially exempted from impoverishment, and some are exempted from any kind of autonomy. And austerity measures are not economic measures, as I've argued extensively in the book. They are really a political tool, and they are, in fact, interfering with national sovereignty. I mean, we are in a very strange situation. The national economy is no longer possible, even in a country like this one, although the United States is such a peculiar country and nation that, it's sort of at the edges of the paradigm. But in terms of classic national states, if there's something that defines national sovereignty, it's really not law, constitution, or state, but the fact, I'm talking about modern societies, obviously, but the fact that there could have been, up until somewhat recently, a national economy, a certain kind of, literally speaking, a kind of sense of control over your space, or, you know, a kind of, you know, economy, think of economy in relation to its household idea. Since that's no longer the case, we are in a situation that is, on the one hand, similar to being kind of pre-World War I situation, where great powers and great bankers are making decisions, very, very dangerous and troubling. Ukrainian thing is very indicative of that. And at the same time, though, different insofar as the speed and scale with which this is happening is unprecedented. So the question arises: what sort of politics what sort of emancipatory politics, what sort of democratic politics can be practiced in specific societies when they're, in fact, they've lost their sovereignty. And they've lost their sovereignty in terms of economics. I mean, really lost their sovereignty because decisions are made outside their boundaries about their future. This pertains even to societies that are strong, not just I'm not just talking about the peripheral ones. Bless you. So it seems to me that this can only be a kind of a politics that cannot that has to understand. First of all, it raises the question of re-territorializing politics, which I would like us to explore. It's you know, deterritorialization is an idea that we've all championed for years. It's now the mainstream logic of capital. So we've got a problem. We've got to think beyond that. We have to think at the same time of the dangers behind the notion of re-territorialization. You know, nationalism is lurking everywhere. In some ways, very violent fashion. So I want us to think of that. That's one of the notions that we can discuss. The other notion would be a certain kind of radical democratic politics that would understand very well that people's differences, though they're irreducible, they're outmaneuverable, they're singular, that people's actual differences as individuals are that do not stop them from being essentially substitutable as citizens in terms of participating in politics. So there shouldn't be absolutely no difference between me and any one of you in terms of being political actors, even though the difference between me and any one of you can be enormous in all kinds of ways. This is an idea I think that Ranciere has done a very good job with, and you know he's open to criticism, of course, no doubt. But that's another thing to explore. I'm just going to leave this completely open and elaborated so that we can discuss them, so I can stop talking. And then the other aspect would be to imagine a kind of left governmentality, a kind of let's say democratic left, even within the boundaries of the electoral system. I'm all in favor of direct democracy and all that, but we have to think it's to some extent in terms of practicality. A kind of left that would understand itself not just to be an oppositional force, a kind of just simply negative critical force, but would understand itself to be a governing force, a governing capacity here meaning understanding governance. So even let's say if you are an opposition party in a representative parliamentary, let's say, democracy, you cannot say that you are exempted. Again, that's a term that I use all over here. That you're exempted from governance just because because somebody else has been elected and are running the government. Even opposition within a parliamentary system is sharing in the responsibility of governance. This is something that the kind of the imaginary of the left in Europe, its history from Marxism on to all kinds of other aspects, has not really done very well with. Obviously because there's been a sort of sense of opposing the status quo. One consequence of that way of thinking would be, and this is again of concern in terms of practicality, let's say this party in Greece comes to power, it may not happen, but let's say it does. One of the first things that it has to do, literally, it has to restore, you know, legality in society. It has to actually to restore a certain kind of lawfulness. Because it is a society where, in some ways, not that different from many societies, but perhaps to an extreme degree, power itself, at the highest level, operates illegally, outside the realm of the law. And if, you know, we take for granted that transgressing the law, insofar as the law is the law of the powerful and status quo, has been part of the history of kind of leftist thinking, now we have to deal with we realize that transgressing the law is no longer a radical act, because the ones who transgress the law most and better than anybody else are the people who govern. So a kind of an imaginary that would restore a certain kind of of nomos against a kind of paranomia of power would be an essential element of this process that I call left governmentality. And the last one, I'll close with that. This is something that I saw, in some ways it's something that it's sort of experiential, if I may put it that way, although it has all kinds of theoretical consequences. The assembly movement, which is already, okay, I'm generalizing by using this term, a whole bunch of things that are very different, but, you know, bear with me. The assembly movements were characterized by a fascinating pedagogical experience. People who really did not know each other, had absolutely no connection with each other, and would not have come close to each other under any other circumstances, let's say at work or at a party or what have you, gathered themselves together in a public space out of a sense of something that was common. And they had to learn what this might mean, because they refused any kind of authoritative structure. There was no you know, sacred text or master point of knowledge that authorized what they did. They did these things in some ways, you know, spontaneously, with all the problems that this term has in the history of political philosophy. And what happened that was fascinating was an extraordinary kind of autodidactic process, that people learned that they are learning, you know, of themselves, by themselves, together with others. This kind of autodidactic pedagogy is also epitomizes for me this kind of Aristotelian point that I've been arguing for a lot. The fact that arche, rule, is always subject to the knowledge of ruling and being ruled simultaneously. That being ruled is actually a position of autonomy, knowing how to be ruled, or having power over being ruled, which is the essence of a democratic society, is in fact a positive, affirmative, that is, position of autonomy. So I think that I'm going to leave it like that, somewhat incoherent, so that we can then bring it together by just having a conversation.